Good morning. It is Friday, April 19th, 2013. This is the Executive Girlfriends Group, and I would like to welcome you to the show today. We are interviewing the author of a fascinating book called Red Thread Thinking, Weaving Together Connections for Brilliant Ideas and Profitable Innovation. And the author's name is Deborah Kay, and I'm going to introduce her in a second, but first I just want to comment that this particular show and this particular topic is so core to what we've been talking about really for the entire existence of the Executive Girlfriends Group, being able to recognize connections in your life and to leverage that for new idea generation, profitable innovation, and growth is really the message that we want to create for our audience. So, Deborah, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You didn't know you played right into our sweet spot.
Yeah, that's fascinating to hear.
Well, you know, it should be everybody's sweet spot. I'm sure you think that as well. So tell me how you came up with the title Red Thread Thinking.
Well, it's actually very interesting because it wasn't really me who came up with it. It was one of my partners. When I first started writing the book, my partners, you know, looked at me and they said, Deborah, this doesn't sound like you. This sounds very academic and not the way you teach our kids at all. Why don't you write like you speak? And I said to them, you mean the red thread? And they said, yeah, the red thread. Because that's what I tell my kids. I always tell them, you know, my kids, well, I mean the people that I work with when I say that. I always say, look for the red thread. Look for that underlying connection that connects the dots.
Right.
And so when we went back and looked, we found that there's actually an ancient legend, an ancient Asian legend about the red thread, and that's how the title came to be.
Well, that is really remarkable because I tell a similar story. Actually, it's a book by Ravi Zacharias, who is one of the great thinkers of the world, and he wrote a book called The Grand Weaver. And without spending too much time on it, you should grab the book because the first part tells the story about how he goes to visit a factory in the north of India that made this fabulous fabric for saris. And anyway, so it's the whole story of how he uncovers the father who is guiding the threads and the son who's sitting at the feet moving the shuttle back and forth. And he doesn't talk specifically about the red thread, but the brilliant threads that come through. But you also have to deal with the black and the gray and the brown and those that aren't so interesting so that the red thread can stand out.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. And that's exactly it. I mean, in what I do, we deal with so much information. So you really have to find the underlying connective tissue, and that's what the red threads are all about.
Right, right. Well, I want to start really with hearing a little bit about your background. We'll jump into the book with both feet in a couple of minutes. But why don't you tell us about yourself, Deborah?
Oh, it's always so difficult to talk about oneself. I've had a very fortunate life in that most of my career was in Europe, and I had my own company in Spain, which was a marketing and innovation company, and I had a fabulous team, and we were very fortunate that we created some of the world's greatest products, and we won 100 international awards, and 8 of them were in Cannes, and we were bought by Omnicom, and then I went to become CEO of a very large advertising agency in Italy, which is a global agency called TBWA, and I was CEO of the Italian part of that. And then I started my own skincare brand in the United States, which was very, very successful, and then sold that. And then I started an innovation and culture consultancy company here in the United States, which is called Lucule.
Wow. So
yes.
Tell me, you know, again, you were prompted by colleagues and friends who said, you know, you really ought to put all of these thoughts into a book. Had you ever considered writing before?
No, absolutely not.
And no, the million-dollar question is, would you do it again?
you know, I really don't know. It is a lonely process.
Yes.
And I'm a person who thrives off of working with people. People have asked me a lot of times, what do I think is my greatest achievement? And when they're asking me that, they're asking me to say, what is the greatest product I ever came out with? And, I've come out with some billion-dollar brands. And my answer to that is, it's never a product. My greatest achievement is that some of the people that have worked for me, when they leave me, they go off and make three times more money. Some of the people who have worked for me are now top executives in businesses all over the world. That's my greatest achievement. And so writing a book for me was a very lonely process. And so I'm not sure if I'm prepared to do it again.
Right. Yeah, it's daunting. I took on my first book and had a publisher who came to me and asked me to write the book. So I was fortunate in that I didn't have to go and shop it around. But, here I thought I was going to make a boatload of money. And, ended up spending 9 months of my life because, I couldn't afford a research assistant. And it was a very research-heavy publication. But, I'll tell you, when I was done with that book and I read it cover to cover, I couldn't believe that I had been the one to write it. And so it did marvelous things for me. And, I was a consultant at the time, and I think I was charging, probably $1,000 a day before I wrote the book. And after I wrote the book, I thought, wow, I know a lot. And so I, doubled and tripled my consulting rates, in very short order, and then, wrote four additional books. And so it did, I made money, but it wasn't where I thought it would.
Well, that's great. I mean, one of the reasons, everybody asked me to write a book, but one of the reasons, of course, there are always selfish motives behind it, was I was very well known in Europe, and when I came back to the United States, everyone said, you need to be known in the United States to grow your business, and you need a platform. So that was obviously one of the reasons I wrote the book as well.
Well, let's dive right into it then. So there are really just I believe, five threads that you outline, and I'm sure that there are others that you talk about as you're going through this. But talk to us about innovation and why it's not just having a good idea, because that's really how you start the book.
Right, and you do a lot of learning when you write the book, and what I've learned is I never would have put innovation in the title, which is an interesting thing, because the book isn't really about innovation in a lot of ways. I am an innovation professional, but what I think the book is really about is how to have an idea, where to look for ideas. I think we all go through the problem of when you sit down and you have to come up with ideas, whether it's, how you teach someone to think differently in your office, or whether how you come up with a new strategy, you kind of sit down and say, oh my goodness, where am I going to come up with that idea? And no one has the tools to teach you how to have an insight. And I think that's what this book is all about. And so the idea is that anyone can really have inventive ideas any day of the week, no matter what age you are or where you come from. And this book gives you the tools to do that. And that's what Red Thread Thinking is all about.
Well, I think it's interesting that you start with innovation, being the first red thread. And the subtitle of that chapter is It's All in Your Head. And you mentioned something about how anyone can have an idea. And I think what can be daunting to folks is that they may have an idea, and you've heard, dozens of people say, oh, I wish I had thought of that. Or they'll say, I thought of that, and I never did anything with it. And that can be that one thing that holds them back. So talk to us about It's All in Your Head and how you need this significant change of mind to actually tap into that innovation. And I love the second subchapter here, which is Stop Brainstorming and Take a Shower.
Well, I'm going to talk to two points about that, and particularly since this is called the Executive Girlfriends Group, women in particular hold ourselves back. I work with a group called Count Me In, which is a group to help women create million-dollar businesses. And what we find is that the biggest holdback to women growing our businesses is that we second-guess ourselves all the time, and we're really afraid to when we have a new idea, to move with it. And so what the first chapter in the book is all about is freeing up our minds and being much more positive. So the first chapter in Red Thread Thinking is about how you become a better observer of life and how you allow yourself to become a freer thinker. So there's something that we do as we get older, which is called, I love this expression, and it's hard to even say three times fast, functional fixedness, which is basically, and we can all appreciate this, if you have a burr that falls on your sweater, what we all tend to do is pull that burr off and say, ugh, a burr, this is disgusting, and throw it on the ground. But if we could all pull that burr off and say, oh, a burr, why did this stick to my sweater? Look at this curious little thing. Oh, it has these little things. We could invent the next Velcro. And so that's what this book, the first chapter, does. It makes you ask questions in a different way. It opens up your mind. And what we've learned, just like athletes, you know, we teach them to visualize the goal line and they're more apt to win. This teaches you to open up your mind and think you're smarter. And if you think you're smarter, you'll be smarter. And that's what the first chapter is all about.
Oh, I love that. So tell me about the stop brainstorming and take a shower. I love that one.
Well, you know, there's been more research in the last 15 years about our brains than in the last 500 years. And what we found is that brainstorming doesn't work. And why doesn't it work? Think about yourself. When do you get your best ideas?
That would be in the shower, anytime when it's quiet and there aren't people pulling at me.
Exactly. So if you're in a big brainstorming session and somebody says, give me an idea on demand, it's not going to work. First of all, you're amongst your peers. You're going to be afraid to say the idea. Second of all, you're so focused on having to come up with an idea. Nobody's brain works that way. Right? And what happens is we come up with our best ideas when our brain is at rest and we're not so focused on the situation. So actually what we've learned is brainstorming meetings don't work. You don't come up with new original ideas because our mind is not at rest when all these little connections and all these little synapses can happen. So really, if you want to come up with great ideas, go clean the house. Go take a walk. Go take a shower. Then, once you have the initial idea, then you need a lot of people's input, absolutely, to improve the idea, to be a devil's advocate, but not for the initial idea. Brainstorming doesn't work.
Exactly. Exactly. And in fact, I want to come back to that because, you know, part of what you talk about in this book is, you know, tapping into those connections and leveraging those connections. And I was just telling one of my colleagues yesterday that, you know, every place where you are in what you're doing, you need to go off and have some quiet time to figure out what all of the connections are that people and events of the past and even previous roles that you've had, if it was all, you know, for such a time as this, for where you are today, what would you pull from each of those things? And, you know, some people, it's really natural. I'm a dot connector big time. I mean, that if I had to describe myself, that's the one term I would use.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, well, it's a gift. I mean, it's nothing that I've nurtured. It just was something that was given to me. You can't possibly go to the store and buy it. But it is something that I believe that you can take that quiet time and draw those connections. And, you know, likewise, sometimes you have to have that burr. I thought you were going a different place with the burr, but I now get the Velcro thing. But I thought you were talking about how do you learn from the bad things that occur in your life so that you can recognize the good. And one of the talks I give when I do public speaking is about black holes and diamonds, and that when you look at a diamond mine, it's this enormous black hole. I mean, it is miles and miles and miles wide. Unlike other kinds of mining for precious metals and stones. And, you know, if you go back through your life, it's the same kind of thing. You see those things that lead you to finding the diamond in your life. So I can see how the red thread would be that same kind of thing. So let's go to the next red thread, which is everything old is new. And that, actually, that kind of speaks to what I just said. Interesting.
No, but also to follow up what you're saying, you've just spoken about one of the great innovator secrets of all time, which is you learn from your mistakes. I mean, Thomas Edison said that, you know, he had to create, you know, 90,000 mistakes to get one success. So you that wasn't the exact quote, but it was something like that.
Right.
You absolutely learn from your mistakes that, you know, no one gets it right the first time. And that is what, you know, and persistence and passion means, that you look at it and you learn from your mistakes. That's the greatest thing you can do. And that's part of why you're such a good connector. And I do think connecting is something that can be learned, by the way.
Well, it can, but that intuitive ability to see the connection of completely inobvious things in your life. And sometimes it's a bit frustrating because I actually see them before I know what to do with them. So I have to tuck them away sometimes. I'm the sticky note queen, which is, I guess, the other big mistake in life of glue that wouldn't hold. And, I will take sticky notes and just write the names of people on them and put them on a wall as placeholders because I know they're going to be connected with something else in my life soon.
That's fabulous. You are an innovator at heart.
Well, yes, absolutely. So let's talk about the first chapter under Everything Old is New, which is Get Clued In on the Real Story. Tell us about that.
Well, the most important thing of Everything Old is New is that there really isn't any such thing as an original idea. Most original ideas aren't completely original. Every innovation, every new idea really sits on the shoulders of another idea that came before it. So there's plenty of information, products, materials, and technology that can be looked at in a fresh way and modified and somehow used again. I mean, every mother, who has a little issue at home, probably jerry-rigs something in some way to make it work.
Right.
She's an innovator. She just doesn't know it. And so that's what really we do every day of our lives. So the difference is that you realize, the book helps you realize that that's what you're doing, and how do you take that and turn that into something very innovative? There are hundreds of women out there who've been able to turn those kinds of ideas into innovative products. I'm forgetting the name, but the woman who created that little knapsack that you carry your child in front of you with, she
right.
did that out of a need to carry her child in front of her. And she created, a multi-million dollar brand as a result of it. So we do that every day in our lives, and that's what this Everything Old is New is all about. So what the book is giving you are saying you have the tools. You don't have to be somebody special to really understand that. Just work from what you know.
Right, right. And so then you lead into Stop Crying Over Spilled Milk, because the glass is, in fact, still half full.
Exactly. So in terms of companies, basically, and if you have a company, there are probably a lot of underused assets that you have that can be used in a new way. One of the stories that I love to tell is there was a dairy company in New Zealand called the Fonterra Dairy. And as a waste product from the dairy products they were creating, and the dairy business was down all over the world, they had this whey protein, which was a waste product. And they were throwing it away, but their dairy business was down. And an innovation company, unfortunately not ours because it was a great idea, had the idea that this whey protein, because it was whey is a protein,
right.
And it was a dissolvable protein, why not sell it to these protein drink companies to up the protein in these protein drinks, in these energy drinks?
Right.
They branded it Clear Protein, and in the first year, that waste product sold out across the world. So again, look at your assets, look at what you have, and you might turn it into it. There are some gentlemen, they call it trash speakers. They take old Coke cans that people have thrown away, and they turn them into speakers. And in their first year, they sold $100,000 worth of speakers.
That's amazing. I'll tell you another one, although it will make you never want to buy the product ever again. I used to work with a guy who was a chemical engineer, and he worked for a chemical plant, and they had all this chemical sludge that was, again, being wasted out of the factory. And so they put a bunch of their engineers on the task, and they made it into a vitamin C equivalent that is now the core ingredient in Jolly Rancher candy. So
wow.
There you have it. If you have Jolly Rancher candy at home, they've taken out everything that's unsafe, but just the concept that it's made out of industrial sludge, I can't get past it.
It's very hard to get past. But I like to say to anyone, just think about what bugs. If you want to be start a home business, or if you have a current business, and you want it to be more ecologically sound, or more environmentally sound, and you're passionate about that, think about what bugs you. Just
right.
Think about what bugs you, and think about how you might solve that problem. Chances are, what bugs you bugs a whole lot of other people. And that's an innovation waiting to happen.
Right. Well, our executive producer, Patty, has been constantly on me because my daughter, who just turned 15 this week, whenever she wears a T-shirt, she takes a rubber band and ties it in the back to tighten the T-shirt against her body. Now, she's a very modest girl, so I don't get on her about it. But every time Patty sees it, she says, we could make a device that would sell millions on TV. And it's like, well, you know, I'm just not in the product innovation business, but somebody is. So
well, see, that's a great idea.
It is.
You could probably create an adorable little product, and that's a great idea.
Definitely. Well, let's move on to Red Thread 3, which is people, the strangest animals in the zoo.
Well, this is very interesting because every innovator or every inventor of a new idea thinks, oh my goodness, I have a new idea. I'm going to change the world. And we absolutely think that's the wrong thinking because it is really difficult to change people's habits. Just think of the billions of dollars that were poured into no smoking campaigns, and people didn't stop smoking. The real reason that people finally slowed down on their smoking was because access was cut off. You couldn't smoke in restaurants anymore. You couldn't smoke in offices. The no smoking marketing campaigns actually didn't work. So if you think because you've got this great idea and you need billions in marketing dollars to sell it, then you don't have a great idea. So what we tell people is you have to think of culture. You have to think of people's habits and what's really there and make your idea fit into those habits. Don't think your great idea is going to change people's habits because you don't have enough money to do that, no matter how rich you are. So what we say is look at the underlying culture. A great example of that is Apple. Apple could have created a beautiful MP3 player because they're great at design, but they understood that people didn't want just a prettier MP3 player with more features. What people wanted was to get to music faster and easier, so they created iTunes. They created a one-stop, one way of getting your music much easier than any other MP3 player had done. And by doing that, Apple now owns 90% of the delivery of all music.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I've been an Apple aficionado for a very, very long time. In fact, I tell the story, a guy that I was dating back in, I believe it was 1983, we were in California for Thanksgiving, staying with his brother, and his brother was one of the lead designers for Apple. And I had to sign a non-disclosure to sleep in the guest room because the Apple Lisa, which was the precursor to the Macintosh, was sitting on the floor. So anyway, I was an early exposed individual to the Apple culture, and then became I worked for American Airlines Sabre for many years, and I was the very first Macintosh there. So I have a great appreciation for their marketing sense and the whole issue of simplicity, which I think is the thing that you were trying to get at there, is that we sometimes overthink. And your next chapter is actually called We Think, Therefore We Innovate. And I would introduce that we overthink the solution. We try to overcomplicate. And I think that's where a lot of innovation is lost.
Right. Again, you know, we are our own worst enemies because when we come up with these great ideas, we think that everybody else is going to be impressed with them as we are, and we forget that we are operating in a very complex world. So people don't have the time to notice all the difficult things that, you know, all the bells and whistles that we're putting in. They want to keep it as simple as possible and get to the story as fast as possible. So we really believe in simplicity, and don't get me wrong. Creating simplicity is very, very, very difficult because you have to find your most important characteristic and make it sing, and that's not easy. It's very hard.
Yeah. And I'm right with you there. I've spent the bulk of my career as a strategic planner, and you know it is way easier to write a 100-page business plan than to write a 2-page executive summary.
Yes. you certainly got that.
Exactly. I want to touch on one more of the subchapters under the strangest animals in the zoo, and that's where you talk about emotional memory and the culture tattoo. Tell me about mm-hmm. that. I'm intrigued.
Well, again, it's more about really understanding the underlying culture. You know, we do things out of habit that we don't even realize. So the way, for example, people, there are underlying cultural values that are very, very strong, and then you have to relate that back to products. So people think today, so one of the underlying cultural values that we hold very dear as Americans, for example, is this idea of that we can invent and reinvent ourselves. That's very, very important to us. That's the reason that social media has taken hold so quickly, because mm-hmm. it does allow us to do that. And so now people are saying that Facebook, they say, oh, teens are leaving Facebook because they're bored with it. It's not that they're bored with it. It's that the world is changing very fast. And so now what Facebook is, Facebook now is a lasting value concept. So what teens see is, okay, when I go on Facebook, it lasts there. So I have to kind of curate it because my personality lasts there. But now there's this new thing, for example, called Snapchat.
Snapchat. Hey, right? Can you tell which I've got a 15-year-old?
Exactly. Which is I can show my emotion, which was only a 3-second emotion, which
right.
is so I can reinvent myself every 3 seconds. So that, again, goes to this lasting underlying value. So people think that that's actually a fad, but it's actually not, because it's playing into this deep underlying value. So it's not that they're leaving Facebook.
Right.
It's just that Snapchat is playing to this underlying value that's very, very strong. And so,
and what an innovation that was, to not have to store all that stuff. So not only did they cater to the cultural tattoo, but they also managed to put together an amazing business model where you don't store anything.
Exactly.
Amazing.
So it's very, very clever. And, you know, Facebook, they paid $1 billion for Instagram, and that
right.
was clever. They haven't quite figured out, I don't think, their financial model exactly why they bought it.
Right.
But they understood in their gut that there was a reason to do it.
Exactly, exactly. So let's move on to red thread number 4, which is what you see is what you get. Now, we've heard people say that for eons. So tell me what it means to you.
Well, there's a lot of parts to that. The first thing is we've heard that for eons, but the question I would have to you is, do people really practice it? I'm not sure they do. So let's say you have a new product, a new ingredient in a cereal box. But when you look at the cereals on the shelf, they all still look like the same cereals, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
So if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, why are we still packaging it in a chicken box?
Right.
So we're not following through on that. We're not giving consumers the opportunities to really see the differences. We're still being very staid and conservative in our ways of thinking. And we're still using words to communicate everything at the shelf when you only have 3 seconds to communicate at the shelf.
Right.
You know, what I'd love to use as a model is the Olympics, right? People from all over the world go to the Olympics, and we have managed to communicate everything from every single sport event to food to bathrooms to directions in icons.
Mm-hmm.
I wholeheartedly, and this is very forward thinking, encourage people to begin to think more in pictures.
Right. And you end this section of the book talking, let me just first say that chapter 9 is Simple is Smarter, which is really the Apple story that we were just talking about, and then you bringing up the Olympics is this ability to communicate globally with a picture. You also talked about packaging, which the next chapter is about good things that come in great packages. But the last one is Draw Me a Story, and storytelling is so powerful. I'm from the travel industry. That's where I've spent the bulk of my career. And recently I had a new client come to me, and they had a product that uses video for storytelling. And, you know, you would say, duh, well, you know, that's what it's all about. And I really thought video was way more pervasive in the travel industry than it is. And in fact, I've been stunned to find out how little it is used. But it is such a powerful storytelling vehicle. And in telling a story, you actually can convert business. And the one example of that that completely surprised me was Zappos. And I don't know if you shop on Zappos. I don't happen to, but my client wrote a blog about this, that Zappos actually went out and did a bunch of videos of shoes. And you're like, videos of shoes? What in the world would you do? But it increased their conversion by some astronomical double-digit number. So talk to me a little bit more about drawing a story, because that one fascinates me.
Well, you know, pictures are emotional. I'll give you two examples. The first example is there is a huge difference between I heart New York and saying I love New York. You know, if you see a heart, it just has all these emotional meanings. It has all this history behind it. If you see the word love, it's so hackneyed. You know, we're so used to it, it doesn't really have any meaning behind it. But if you, you know, what I love to do when I'm in some sort of big meeting, and everybody has to get up and talk about themselves and introduce themselves, right?
Okay.
What I like to do is I like to, instead of introducing myself in the normal way, saying I'm Deborah. Okay, but here's my background. What I do is I use icons to draw my background. Instead of words. And I get up and I just draw the pictures. And then, you know, I point to the pictures to describe myself. And what I find is people then are so much more friendly to me because they feel like they know me in a completely new way because those pictures draw emotional meaning. And also those pictures communicate to everyone in a much broader way. And so I always suggest to people when you're in a room and introducing people, it does two things. It draws people out because it forces them to think in pictures about themselves, which makes them be more highly creative and stimulates the meeting in a whole new way. But it also makes the people feel more emotionally drawn to that person.
I think pictures
are just a warmer way to go.
Huh, I may have to redo my bio on my website. I love that. Well, let's move on to the last one in the 5 minutes that we have left. The last red thread, number five, is called the force of passion. And here you talk about emotion and reason.
Yes, and that's because passion is both. In leadership, passion motivates one to persevere, so passion is the emotion, and really persistence beyond reason. Persistence is also the part of the reason where you have to learn to pivot and shift. So in leadership, passion really motivates one to be persistent, but in both business and innovation, they're both very iterative processes with lots of trial and error. You never get it right the first time. So passion is the thing that helps you move through the mistakes, to continue to believe, and to push through when things aren't working and need to be revised. Truly passionate entrepreneurs embrace the negatives about an idea. That's what we were talking before. And then the reason is really the part where you have to see the negatives. You have to fess up, and you have to see the negatives, and you have to see them as pathways to workable solutions and alternative approaches. That's where you have to allow the reason to kick in. And another thing is the passion really fuels the enthusiasm. And that is critical if you're an entrepreneur. It's also critical if you're a leader. If you're a leader, it's critical that people believe in you in order to lead them. But if you're an entrepreneur, you know, 50%, if you're looking to raise money, 50% is, yes, they believe in your business, they believe in your business plan and your financial model. But the other 50%, if you're looking to raise money, is they believe in you.
Right.
So that passion has to come through when you're looking for funding. So, you know, this red thread to me is a very critical red thread.
Well, and it's one that's near and dear to my heart because I am constantly raising money for both my clients and for projects that I've got underway. And I know, you know, it's interesting because I frequently will work with investment bankers. And so I write this incredibly emotional and visual plan document, and I don't even call it a business plan anymore because, of course, the first thing they want to do is to turn it around and turn it into this boring, you know, death by text and death by numbers document. And I think you do need to tap into that emotion, and the emotion actually presents the reason, and I think that really is the bottom line of what you just said. So the epilogue for this book, I find this one curious as well, and so I would love to hear your take on this. The epilogue is Where Innovators Can Take Capitalism.
Well, I just believe today that if you're starting a new business, there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity to do something for society. I think that I am a capitalist. I firmly believe that it's capitalism that can help the world. It's capitalism that can lift up the world. You know, I believe that the way out of poverty is to have people working, because I think by people working, they create their own sense of self-confidence and things like that. So if you're starting a business today, everybody has something that they are passionate about in terms of how they want to help the world. So figure out a way, whether it's something about the environment, whether it's something about helping indigenous people to be able to find a way of working. Find what that thing is and find how your business can help in that way. And I don't mean it in just in giving charity, because I don't, you know, I think, of course, we should all give to charities. But there may be a way that you can actually help. For example, if you need your product dyed, if it's a fabric, maybe you can create a way of having it dyed in communities in Latin America. They're fabulous dyers. And maybe you can have it dyed there and therefore give people work who don't have work. If you want to help the environment and you have and you create your product in cans, you can reduce the amount of metal. One of my clients actually creates pet food, and we found that by reducing the amount of metal just by 5% in the top of the can, we were able to reduce their footprint, their footprint an enormous amount in terms of the environment. So there are little things that you can look at, especially if you're creating a new business, that you can do things that will really change the world, and I really believe in that.
Well, changing the world is one of my passions, and I am just so glad that you took this time today to share Red Thread Thinking with us. So much of it resonates with me, and we could probably talk for much, much longer, but we are nearing the end here. And again, the subtitle of this book is Weaving Together Connections for Brilliant Ideas and Profitable Innovation. Our guest has been Deborah Kay. And, Deborah, thank you so much for devoting some of your Friday to us. Can you tell folks how they can learn more about you? And, of course, for our members, we have the Executive Girlfriends Group bookstore, so they can purchase it there. And, of course, it's available on Amazon and through any of the other major bookstore chains. So how can they get in touch with you, Deborah?
Through the website, which is redthreadthinking.com.
Great. Great. Well, thank you again. And just giving us your time is such a great gift to each of us. And sharing the high points of the book, there is so much practical information in this book. So I hope our listeners will go out and purchase it right away.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
All right, Deborah. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.